This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
You know, when I come to work every day, I think of why we come to work. Because to live at our peak physical, emotional, and intellectual performance, irrespective of age, gender, or health status is a universal human aspiration and a human right. And that's why we all come to work, to meet this aspiration. But what is the end game? The end game is, I think, we all want to celebrate our 100th healthier year. And that's really the goal. And if you don't have that goal, make it a goal, because there is a lot more to life. Because when you live up to 100 years, 100 healthy years, then you have time for multiple acts. You can have your second act or third act. And when you have those acts, sometimes those acts are in the family. You can be great-grandfather. You will live with many people. You may even amend your relationships with some people you didn't like now. And then independence. So when you aim to live longer, you also adopt healthy lifestyle. And that helps you to live independently. Live and finish at your own term, not at anyone else's term. And that's also important. And then by living longer, you can do what you are doing right now. You can engage with the community. You can give mentorship. You can volunteer. And you'll be the intergenerational glue. And in fact, when there is some crisis, we don't go to some teenagers to ask for help. We actually go for people who have lived through it and have survived it. So we look up to older adults as the North Star. So be a legend. So that's why we all should aspire to live a long, healthy life. But then the question is, why can't we live a long, healthy life? What's stopping us? And if we just take a moment and think about what are the things that actually limit our longevity or healthy lifespan, there are many diseases, and I put them into four different buckets. One is infectious diseases, and we all experienced a few years ago how terrible that can be. But on a daily basis, there are small infections here and there, and then sometimes we fall sick, we get pneumonia, we get something else. And metabolic and chronic disease, as we get older, we are at a high risk for diabetes, high cholesterol, and all of these that actually limit our physical performance and sometimes our emotional performance as well. And that leads to brain health condition. And in fact, nearly 85% of us will experience at least one episode of medically defined depression, anxiety, or some psychiatric condition in our lifetime. And many of us will hide it, will think that we can weather it, and some will seek help. But still, it's astounding that nearly 85% of us will go through at least one episode. And then injuries, I don't have to tell most of you, because I just crossed 50 and I realized that when I get injured, I don't heal that well. And almost all of us, we live with our injuries. Sometimes it's back injury, sometimes it's knee injury, even joint injuries. And it becomes difficult as we get older. So that's why we are always looking for an ideal longevity plan. And the ideal longevity plan should help us to prevent disease, because we know that if you take all the top 10 highest grossing drugs in the United States, for every person they help, there are somewhere between 3 to 24 people who cannot benefit, who do not benefit from that drug. So that means when you fall sick, it's almost like a Russian roulette. And when you combine multiple drugs, then it has contraindication and other stuff. So that's why the best thing is to prevent disease. And then when you fall sick, the plan should also help you to accelerate cure. It's not that you should be taking, just imagine if you can take a drug only for 5 days versus 50 days, you'll go for 5 days. And then it should solve multiple health issues. We are always thinking about that magic pill that will solve everything, but we don't have anything. The only thing we have is Tylenol PM. And so it will cure your headache and maybe it will give you a good night's sleep and maybe reduce your fever. So beyond that, we don't have much. And then quick return to full function. Suppose say you fall, you break your break a leg or something, and your rehab should be faster. So you should have a plan that will also help you to come back to full play sooner. So then the question is there a plan? And I would say that yes, there is a plan. There is a daily plan that's actually written in our DNA. And when you think about 100 years, that's actually 36,500 days. So when you think about every single day, if we live every single day healthy, then that add up ultimately to 36,500 days or 100 years. And this plan is already written in our DNA, and we call this the circadian rhythm, or literally it means the daily 24 hours rhythm. And when I look at circadian rhythm, I feel that's the best biomarker of whether you're healthy or not. Because when you think of circadian rhythm, the first thing that comes to your brain is sleep and wakefulness. For example, if you're lucky enough to have gone to bed around 10 o'clock, and if you're completely healthy and sound, then you may have uninterrupted 6 to 7 hours of sleep. So you were in bed for 8 hours and maybe you got 7 hours of sleep. And within the first couple of hours, you get what is your deepest sleep. And that's when the growth hormone spikes. And although the name is growth hormone, we actually need that growth hormone throughout our life, because every single day we damage nearly 1/10 to 1/15 of our cells. So that means our intestinal lining actually turns over every 15 days. Our skin turns over completely in every 15 days. And this growth hormone spike helps us to repair and rejuvenate at night. And then now there is new finding that when we sleep, our brain literally detoxifies. So that means there is this glymphatic system that takes all the toxins away from our brain and drains into our glymphatic system and ultimately to our bloodstream and out. And anticipating waking up, your body temperature begins to rise, your heart begins to pump a little faster, you breathe a little faster so that you can wake up. Because waking up is a big thing for the body. Just imagine, you're just lying there without much sensation and you are into deep sleep. And waking up is a huge physiological change. And that's the reason why when daylight saving time changes and you fall back by 1 hour, that's the morning when there's a spike in heart attack, because the body was not ready to wake up. And when you force it to wake up, heart was not ready, and you're forcing it to pump faster. And that's one reason. And this experiment has been going on for almost 100 years. And we always see on that day, there is a spike in heart attack. And after waking up, your melatonin level will begin to decline. That's the night hormone that helps you to sleep. And your cortisol, the stress hormone, spikes within an hour of waking up. And in fact, the highest level of cortisol that you'll experience in the entire day happens in the morning. Even if you're going into an open heart surgery and in the afternoon, that amount of stress does not beat the morning cortisol. So the morning cortisol is, and in fact, there is a famous circadian researcher who got into research looking at this cortisol peak and realized that this is very strong rhythm that happens every single day. If you have a healthy gut, then your bowel movement is most likely within a couple of hours of waking up. And your highest insulin sensitivity, that means your ability to digest and absorb nutrients from a carbohydrate-rich diet, is much better in the first half of the day until noon. And your alertness peaks around between, say, 12 to 2 o'clock. And maybe thank you for arranging my talk around 1 o'clock. Everybody is alert. And their muscle performance and joint performance actually peaks in late afternoon, because your body has warmed up and muscles are flexible. And in fact, this is the time when we should be doing our exercise. And then hunger actually peaks in late afternoon. So it's not a big surprise that you feel hungry late afternoon. And then in the evening, melatonin rises and body cools down and you go back to sleep. And that's the healthy sign of circadian rhythm, and that healthy circadian rhythm is also the sign of good health. And then how do we dissect it? Now let's break it down and think about how to drive a good circadian rhythm so that you can live healthy life. So if you think about it, we have an internal circadian clock, and I'll get to that. And that essentially drives three foundations of health: that's sleep, nutrition, and exercise. So it times when we should sleep, how long we should sleep. It also, if we have the healthy circadian rhythm, it also tells us when to be hungry and to be just hungry enough, not too much, so that we stop binge eating. And if we have a strong circadian rhythm, then we also have a strong, good muscle function to exercise. And we also know that when we eat, when and how much we eat affect our sleep, and nutrition affects our exercise, and exercise affects our sleep. So all these things are interrelated. And everything is also under the control of light and darkness. So sounds very complex, but I will try to break it down to just three simple ideas, because just like learning to drive, it's pedal or gas, brake, and steer. So similarly, here there are three key ideas: light and also darkness, eat and fast, and also move and rest, when to exercise and when to rest. And if we figure out these three and adopt very well, then we can better perform during the day when we are supposed to, and at nighttime we can rejuvenate and repair. Just imagine, human body is not like a machine. We always say that human body is like a machine. Just take out your smartphone and think about it. Your smartphone is maximum 5 year old. If our body was like a smartphone, then in every 5 years we had to reset our brain and then download new software and also maybe change few features. So this is the best thing we have. This is the, I think, the biggest challenge to science now is to understand how the human body works. And so the best thing we can do to our body is to take care of it well. And so now let's dive into what are circadian clocks and why and how to take care of them. So circadian rhythms are controlled by what we call circadian clocks or 24-hour clocks that are present in every organ and actually in every cell in our body. So as we all can imagine that there is a clock in our brain that tells us when to go to sleep, when to wake up. Every organ, every cell in our body also has its own clock. The brain's function is to act as a master conductor so that all these clocks work together so that we have much better rhythms in physiology, our hormone level, metabolism, when we digest and absorb nutrients, behavior, our mental health, when we are calm and when we are upset, and even our gut microbiome. And in fact, the circadian rhythms are so much everywhere that if you pluck my hair and put it in a dish in a laboratory, then you'll see that my hair will grow only for 7 to 8 hours and then will stop. And then again grow and stop, again grow and stop. And this is a simple idea, but then the implication is those who are getting radiation therapy for cancer, radiation therapy in the morning will lead to loss of your hair. But then in the afternoon, when the repair function is much stronger, we have seen that the same radiation in the mice in the evening preserves 85% of their hair. So that's as powerful as that. So almost every single cell has a clock. That means you can also take my skin fibroblast, scratch it, and then culture it in the dish, and you can tell me whether I'm from this planet or Mars, because whether my clock runs at 24 hours or 25 hours. So you can even get that from my skin. And all these clocks are driven by light that's perceived only through the eyes. You might think that light can affect your skin and vitamin D, but none of that matters for clock. The only light that matters is the light that goes through the eyes. And I'll not talk about why you have a clock, but I'll give you some examples. So the function of the clock is to anticipate. So for example, I told you how before waking up, your body anticipates. So that's how you wake up. Similarly, if we have a regular breakfast time, before our breakfast, actually our pancreas, our gut, they get prepared. They secrete the right digestive juice. And so that's anticipating food the body prepares. And then synchronization and separation. So for example, your bowel movement and your sleep are separated because they're not compatible with each other. And when people break circadian rhythm or don't have a healthy circadian rhythm, or babies who are yet to develop circadian rhythm, that's when they mix up. And that's why babies can pass stool even in their sleep. So the function of the clock is to separate these incompatible processes and also synchronize them compatible processes. So for example, you should be hungry and you should be willing to exercise during the day. Just imagine in the night, if your muscle tone is much better, you'll act on your dream and you'll start sleepwalking. So that's how we synchronize, clocks help to synchronize. And repair and rejuvenation is the biggest thing that the clock does, and that's why we can repair ourselves. So during nighttime, almost every organ, every skin cell, everything repairs. Our cornea, our skin, our gut intestine, our intestinal lining, almost our entire body goes through repair and rejuvenation at nighttime, and this is mostly done by having a functional clock. I'll not go into detail, but then I'll give you one simple experiment that we did a long time ago, because we really wanted to know whether everything actually cycles and what is the proof. We cannot go and take samples from humans, and we wanted to see almost every single brain region, every single organ you can think of, what actually cycles, because maybe our digestive juice turns on and off in the pancreas at the right time, but what about our heart? Maybe there is something else that turns on and off. What about our brain that makes memory? So that's why a few years ago, we did a once-in-a-lifetime experiment. We went to Nairobi, where actually Jane Goodall trained in this institute, and we collected 12 baboons and their organs and tissues in every 2 hours over 24 hours. And we asked a simple question, is there a clock in every organ? And actually, the answer is yes. So these are 64 different tissues and different brain regions, and everywhere you see, there is a spike, so that means there are a certain number of genes that turn on and reach their peak and then turn off. And this is many of the genes turn on. So for example, here the genes are turning on in the late afternoon, and here the genes in the liver are turning on in the morning or in the late evening. So the bottom line is we found nearly 85% of the genome, or almost the entire genome in a baboon, which is non-human primate, has this circadian rhythm in a tissue-specific manner. So that means certain things turn on and off at some time in the muscle, some other genes turn on and off in the digestive system. So everything cycles. And in fact, this became the primer, and now people are finding that from human biopsy samples, almost many of the findings that we found in baboon now translate. So the bottom line is, yes, things cycle, but then the question is, what do they do? And this is a little bit more biological, but if we map what those genes do in different organs, then we find almost every simple cellular process that makes every cell to be healthy, that are clock regulators. So for example, our mitochondria makes energy, but when they make energy, they also damage themselves. And the clock repairs this damaged mitochondria. So similarly, and if you think about it, defect in one or more of these processes lead to one or more of the disease. Almost every human disease, we can boil them down to one or more of these processes that go bad. And circadian, having a strong circadian clock fixes it. So as a result, having a strong circadian rhythm optimizes our immune function so that we are more resilient to infectious diseases. It optimizes repair. For example, our bones actually recycle every single day. So our osteoclast, the one that chew up some bones and that make some bones, they also cycle, and our muscles also cycle. So our repair function is much better. Our brain function is much better, so that we have improved emotional and intellectual performance, and then optimum metabolism and detoxification helps us to be resilient against many of the chronic diseases that reduce our lifespan, so that we can stay resilient, and also we reduce our risk for cancer. So now let's come back to what we can do. I told you that there are three things: light and dark, eat and fast, and exercise and rest. So light, and let's think about light, because I told you that light going through the eyes reset our clock. And what is interesting is since 1915, people had noticed that there are many blind people, not all blind people, there are many blind people who cannot even see the headline of New York Times, but they can sense light. So that means when they travel from West Coast to the East Coast, just like everybody else, they get a jet lag, and after 3 days, they reset their clock, or 7 days, they reset their clock. And if they're in a lighted room, they cannot fall asleep because somehow it keeps them awake. So that led to the idea that there is an image-forming vision that we use to read books, and also there is a non-image-forming vision that, for example, resetting our circadian clock and being unable to sleep in a lighted room. Actually, mice sleep in a lighted room, but humans are different. And so these functions, we call them non-image-forming vision. And this was a puzzle for almost 85 years. And around the turn of the century, in 2001, 2002, when the human genome was sequenced, we and others, three other labs, we discovered a new light-sensing molecule. We call it melanopsin. And this is present in only 10,000 cells in each, 5,000 cells in each human eye. So just imagine, we have nearly 40 million rod and cone cells that give us vision, but these are present in only 5,000 cells. And those are actually the cells, the squiggly cells, that neurons that crisscross the retina. It's almost like a net, like the sun catching net. And this protein or these cells are most sensitive to blue light. And I'll get to that. So, and they also need more bright light. And this is an example of experiment that we did in mice. Mice also have this. So the way to look at it is every single line here is activity rest profile of a mouse. So you are looking at almost 2 months of activity profile. So mice are mostly active during nighttime, unlike humans, and daytime the rest. So after almost a couple of months, we flip the light dark cycle. It's almost like flying somebody from here to New Delhi, 12 hours jet lag. And the mice get almost 10 days of jet lag. They take 10 days to readjust to the new clock, new time zone. But when they don't have this gene, then they take almost 1 month or 1.5 months to reset to the new time zone. So that's the function of this gene. And then why this was important was, you know, this is a blue light sensing protein. So that means blue light, the richest source of blue light is actually daylight. Even now, in a cloudy day, if you go out, you'll get a lot of blue light. And that blue light is very important because during the day, the bright daylight activates melanopsin. It synchronizes our brain clock. It reduces depression, increases alertness. And that's why in winter days in Canada, people get depressed because they don't get enough daylight. They're indoor. That electric lights are on. Everything is on. But they don't get that very bright light. And they're also less sensitive to candlelight and moonlight. So that's why our ancestors, who did not have any electrical lighting, the dim light didn't do anything to this melanopsin system. The melanopsin or the blue light sensors thought, it's dark. So let's turn on the melatonin signal and we'll go back to sleep. So that's what was happening. But for example, you may be curious, like now the light is falling straight on my face and, you know, it's feels very bright, but actually this is only 1,000 lux of light. Actually, it's less than that. It'll be 700 lux because if you ever walk into a CVS store or Walgreens, and you go to where the pharmacist they stand and they're looking for the drugs, that's where it's 1,400 lux. And if you go to say Walmart, the entire Walmart is now 1,200 to 1,400 lux, and this is 700 lux. And most of you are now sitting at 100 to 200 lux. So now why this lighting is very important is now in the modern days, we spend a lot of time in front of bright screen. And this screen, although it looks dim, since it's so close to our face, it actually, this screen at full brightness is bright enough that after an hour or so, it will reduce our melatonin. And in the evening, also when we have bright light in our living rooms, that can also dampen some of the circadian rhythm and can affect melatonin production, and we have poor sleep. And during daytime, as we spend most of our day during in this gloomy indoor environment, that also reduces our alertness, increases depression. And in fact, many people who, after retirement, when they don't commute anymore, they stay home, all of a sudden they feel depressed. And people think that this is because you're missing your work. But you know, very few people are actually very excited about their work. They're not missing their work. What they're missing is the daylight. Many cases, they're missing the daylight. So when these things go on, then you have you complain about sleep, and then you have foggy brain and during the day. So you start to take a melatonin pill in the evening, and you start your day with a big cup of coffee. And that actually doesn't help, because slowly it will lead to different psychiatric condition. And in fact, in long term, it can also increases or exacerbates any other psychiatric conditions we may have. So although light directly has this effect, light is an enabler also, because at light at nighttime will reduce your sleep hormone melatonin. It will keep you awake. And when you're awake, you're not sitting there and meditating. You're actually feeling hungry, or you're watching TV and you're going to the fridge getting some food. And that time, your brain doesn't make good choices. Because in a day, we make more than 200 choices, decisions about food. What to eat, what combination to eat, when to eat, how much to eat, when to stop eating. And just imagine, for every meal, we're making quite a few choices. And when your sleepy brain cannot make those good choices, then you also eat bad food. And that leads to more worse thing. So in fact, if we review the literature, one of the best and worst thing we have in society are shift workers, night shift workers. Without them, the modern society will be impossible. Just imagine the doctors who say, no, they will just work 9 to 5. Or firefighters or bakers. But what we did was we went through last 50 years of data, and we asked what happens when just 2 or 3 nights of sleep disruption. Then nothing bad happens, but there is mood swing, people are more irritable. And in fact, I say that, just make it a point that 1 hour before going to bed and 1 hour after waking up, don't pick up an argument. Just say, yes, you are right, we'll talk about it. Because your brain really doesn't work that well. And if it continues, this sleep disruption or shift work-like lifestyle, if it continues, then it increases risk for many, many diseases. And in fact, we can take even experimental mice, put them in sleep disrupted condition, and we can see how their risk for many of the diseases go up. And our field of circadian rhythm, we essentially think about how to train our circadian clock. That's mostly I'll talk about, and clocking the drugs. Nearly 85% of drugs that you're taking, they have an optimum time when taken at that time, then the drug works the best with least side effect. And the best examples are from 80s and 90s, showing that many of the breast cancer chemotherapy drugs work much better if taken in the morning, and some of the breast cancer chemo drugs taken in the afternoon work better. And now that list is growing. But the challenge is in medicine, it's really hard to put all the patients in morning or all the patients in the afternoon. So the logistical challenge is the biggest drawback here. Okay, so what are the modern lifestyles that cause circadian rhythm disruption? One is shift work, and according to International Labor Organization, staying awake for more than 2 hours and engaging in some kind of work between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. for 15 nights a year. So that means almost all of you are shift worker here. And almost all college students, high school students are shift worker. Everybody who has even all doctors, nurses, of course, and many of us actually live the lifestyle of a shift worker. The reason why 50 nights a year or one night every week is when you stay awake for 2 hours, then it takes your body 2 to 3 days to reset to your own circadian rhythm. So that's why you lose almost half of the week, your body is trying to catch up. The second is social jet lag. If you are socializing at least once a night, and actually this is a big issue in India, where people actually spend a lot of time socializing and staying up till midnight and eating and having fun, but actually that's almost like shift work. And then of course jet lag, who are traveling a lot, and then secondhand shift work. There are many shift workers whose family members want to stay awake or wake up early to give company, and they are also suffering from this. So now that brings to, what can we do? We started with light. Then the question is, what can we do with light? How much light is healthy? And this is the question I always get. Lighting to treat depression, seasonal affective disorders, and ADHD, all of these is around 10,000 lux of light for 1 hour. So 10,000 lux is if you just walk outdoor today with cloud cover, that's 10,000 lux. If you're in San Diego and if it's a bright day, that's 150 to 200,000 lux. So you don't have to sit under the sun to get your 10,000 lux. You can be under a canopy, you can be under a shed, you can be under a tree, you get that 10,000 lux. But an average person who doesn't suffer from any of these, but actually it's better to get that 10,000 lux if you don't, if you can't, at least 1,000 lux, which will be actually not even the front row there, a little bit closer to the large window if you see it. If you have a chair within 1 yard from a large window, then you get roughly 1,000 lux of light. Mm-hmm. And in the evening, you should actually dim down your light to less than 20 lux, and ideally with no red light, no blue light, and then use table lamp and other stuff, and then your phone, there is also night shift and night light feature. And this simple discovery that blue light affects our mood during the day, and avoiding blue light is good for us at night, is changing the lighting industry. Just imagine, for 200,000 years, we controlled fire and we lighted up our house, but mostly for safety. We never thought about how light can be used to improve health. And now thinking about dim light, so this has revolutionized now lighting industry. There are many lights coming up with that is called circadian lighting, human-centric lighting, lighting that will dim down and brighten up. And I thought I should just bring one example of this light. So here is this is the act, my second act. Okay. So this looks like a very simple light bulb, but there is a special light bulb inside. You click it once, it's a very dim red light. Since it's very bright, you don't see it. And this is the kind of light in the night. Suppose say you get up, you want to go to the bathroom, you turn it on, and it's actually red. And it doesn't have any blue light. And I actually use it. You pull it again. You need a little bit more light to check your email or check something. This light is again, doesn't have any blue light. And then during the daytime, whenever you want blue light, then it puts full spectrum. So this is kind of the innovation that's going on around the world. And this is just one example. There are many, many companies that are now building this light bulbs. Many hospitals are redoing their lighting. And this is a $30 billion industry that's going through transformation. Because for the first time, now we know light can be used to improve health. And I'll give you a few more examples. So for example, neonatal ICUs and lighting consideration for postpartum depression. Many women after childbirth, they're mostly indoor and they don't get light. They forget that lack of light may be exacerbating their postpartum depression. And lighting in ICU, lighting to treat mood disorders, and lighting for dementia care, all of these are going on, but everybody should get at least 60 minutes of daylight. And for example, I don't know if you have seen anyone who goes into ICU, the older adults, and stay there. 1 in 3 adults in ICU develop delirium. And there is no medication for delirium because many of the medications have contraindication with whatever treatment they're going through. And there are some studies showing that ICUs that have a large window, the patients don't get as much delirium as the ICUs where there is lack of window, to the extent that now architects are designing even virtual window where there is a scene of a window if you cannot give one. But the best example of light dark comes from babies. We think that babies don't have circadian rhythm, but actually they do. They have it in stealth mode because When neonatal, when the preemies, premature babies are born, they're put into neonatal ICU where the lighting is mostly constant in most of the hospitals. And these babies stay there for weeks sometimes before they can grow and come back home. And there was one experiment done in Mexico City where the doctors decided to randomize these premature babies born before 32 weeks into two groups. One group got constant light, as everybody gets, and then the other group, they just dimmed down the light at night. They're not even turning down, they were just dimming down to 20 lux. And this enabled these babies to grow faster and go home 2 weeks earlier. So now imagine this scale. In the US, 1 in 10 babies are born premature. So that means 380,000 babies are prematurely born every year. And if we can save 15 days and I NICU care, then that's millions of days of NICU care in 20 years, and that's almost $1 trillion in saving, healthcare saving, just by dimming down light in NICU. But this stuff is not done in the US now, because no pediatrician wants to take the risk of dimming down the light, because if the baby has any adverse side, anything, then the parents will sue. And we actually tried this, and this is the unfortunate thing, but slowly I think it will catch up in the rest of the world, and then we'll change our practice. So this is one example. And then you might be thinking, well, we live in San Diego, we get enough light, but actually we do studies with many people. They wear this light sensors that I'm wearing and then previous versions of it. And what we find is, in general, 50% of adults living in San Diego get less than 1 hour of bright light in a day. So, this is not that. So what happens, even I wore the light sensor, and what I realized is the only time I was getting exposure to light when I was driving from home to Salk and Salk to home. But unfortunately, I was also wearing sunglasses, so I was not getting light. So I stopped wearing sunglasses, because inside a car, you don't get UV light. So it's not going to make your skin wrinkled, but actually you do get 5 to 10,000 lux of light. So that's about light. And then let's go to time-restricted eating, or when to eat and when to fast. And so many years ago, what we discovered is, just like if your best friend shows up to your home at 2 o'clock every morning for 4 or 5 nights, that person will not be your best friend anymore. So that means healthy food at the wrong time can be junk. And so that's what we found, that all the light resets the brain clock, the food resets the rest of our clock. The rest of our body, and even more than half of our brain, tracks when we eat. And when we eat at the wrong time, it disrupts our circadian rhythm, and we get into a lot of different diseases. So the idea is very simple. When we eat, we mostly use carb and store a little bit of fat. And if we have, say, 3 meals within, say, 8 to 10 or 11 hours, then we continue to burn carb and store some fat. And after several hours of fasting, then our fat burning will start. And I kind of exaggerated, but that's when the fat burns, then we also get ketone bodies and many breakdown products of fat, and different kind of metabolism starts, and that helps to repair our body. So having this eating and fasting rhythm theoretically gives us these benefits. And then within 15 minutes of eating your next breakfast, this cycle flips. We can go back to burning carb and storing fat. So it takes almost 10 to 12 hours of fasting to slowly start burning fat and repair. But within 15 minutes of putting something in our body, this flips. So then you can imagine that you take the same amount of food spread over a long period of time, and then you may not get that fat burning. So your circadian rhythm of nutrition, absorption and digestion, etc., physiology will be dampened. So the idea is, if you eat within, say, 8 to 10 hours versus 15 hours, you should have different outcome. That was the idea. And 12 years ago, we did a very simple study. We took two identical sets of mice born to the same parents in the same room, had the same gut microbiome, had the same genes. They had the same food every single day and from the same quality of food. The only difference was the first group of mice ate whenever they wanted, and then the second group of mice were fed only for 8 hours. In that first publication, it was 8 hours in 2012. And what we found was the first group of mice, they weighed almost 47 grams. The second group was 34 grams. So that is almost 20% difference in body weight. And the first group were obese, diabetic, had high cholesterol, fatty liver, because of we are feeding them really bad diet. It was almost equivalent to eating all the food from nachos and ice cream. They were as bad as that. But to our surprise, the second group of mice that ate the same diet within 8 hours were completely healthy. And we repeated this study 3-4 times. And every time it came out the same. And then in our second experiment, we took these fat mice and then we put them on what we call time-restricted feeding, which is now popular as intermittent fasting, and they would improve their health. And this was really one of the big breakthrough in nutrition science, I would say, because we knew quality and quantity of nutrient that we eat is important. But this study showed the timing is also important. And unfortunately, the first study was done with 8 hours of feeding and 16 hours of fasting. And that took off in the public media. So now when people think of intermittent fasting or time-less eating, they think 8 hours of eating, 16 hours of fasting. But we actually went back and systematically did 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours of eating and then fasting. What we find is 8 hours, 9 hours, or 10 hours of eating is good enough. So that means we can actually eat for 10 hours and fast for 14 hours. And and some people go to 4 hours or 6 hours, those are very extreme, and we don't know whether those ones have long-term benefits. So now, coming back to now, over the last 15 years, there are many studies showing many benefits in mice, and I'll get to that. And then we are trying to figure out, can all of these benefits be translated to humans? But before that, we wanted to know when people eat. Because if you ask me when I eat, I would simply say, well, I eat my breakfast maybe at 8, and then I have a lunch at work, and then I go home at 5 o'clock, and then I have my dinner. And I won't talk about the late night snacks or nightcap or anything. I won't talk about any snacks, because those we usually ignore. So that's why many years ago, we started a app called My Circadian Clock. It's a very simple app that we developed because we wanted to know when people eat. So we didn't want people to spend too much time on the app. Open the app, one click, take a picture of your food, second click, press save, third click. That's it. And when they pressed save, the picture did not save in their phone. It actually came to our server and we figured out whether the picture had any calorie or not. Suppose say they clicked picture of a glass of water, we'd say, no, that doesn't count as food. Or Diet Coke did not count as food. So this is what we call Feedogram, and we recruited 156 people from San Diego who were not students and were not shift workers and were not part of Salk or UCSD or Scripps who would know about our research. And they were also they were regular people doing 9-to-5 job or staying at home. And this is the eating pattern of one person over 3 weeks. And you might think that this person is an outlier eating so many times, but actually that's true. I mean, if you think about every time this person puts something in the mouth, they have to take a picture or log. And this is the weekday and weekend eating pattern. Weekday, many people eat late in the weekend, so that's the red. And if we put all of this together and put it around the clock, top is 6 a.m., bottom is 6 p.m., this is noon and that's midnight. This is one person's data. You might think this is an outlier, but actually we had 156 people's data. So now, and then for sanity check, we wanted to know whether the records actually reached peaked around noon and evening. It does. That's when people eat their lunch and dinner. And then we had picture of every food. We can guesstimate how many calories are in every food picture. And if we guesstimate each picture, for example, a meal can have 2 or 3 pictures. So we see a little bump during lunch and dinner, but then in the middle of the night when people get up, they're not getting up to eat just half a banana and go back to sleep. They're eating a bowl of cereal with milk or a top of ice cream. So that's what happens. And then what we find is nearly 50% of adults eat for 14 hours, 45 minutes or longer. So if you think about what is the earliest and latest food that we ate over a week, that's the window. We don't think about it because, you know, we forget about all these little snacks, and every snacks count. And then if we think about what time people eat what, how much food, I told you that by midday, the first half of the day is good for digesting large meals, but we consume less than 25% of our food by noon. And in the evening, 3 hours, we eat more food than in the first 8 hours of the day. So we are actually eating a lot of food when our body is not ready to digest that food. We even had them take a picture, and then we had the active watch so we can see what time they're going to bed and waking up. So we can ask, after waking up, how long people wait before they have their first bite that has calories? Or before going to bed, how long before going to bed they actually have their first bite? The bottom line is, within an hour of waking up, nearly 80% of people eat or drink something that has calories within 1 hour of waking up. And within 2 hours before going to bed, 50% of people eat or drink something that has calories. So that means, as long as our eyes are open, our mouth is open. But you know, it doesn't have to be that way. We'll get to that, but the last part is there a right time to exercise? Because most of us, we know that exercise is medicine. Exercise at any time is good for us, so there is no doubt about it. But there are some new things, new discoveries in this area. So a few years ago, two groups, one from Basel, one from Stockholm, they came up with this idea and showed it, both in mice and humans, that athletic performance is much better, there is much better glucose control, and there is low risk for injury if somebody exercises in the afternoon, not evening, late afternoon. So it's, say, between 3 and 6:30, 7 p.m., depending on the sunset time. And then there was another group that came out just recently showing that people who exercise late in the evening, after dinner, for example, you're going to the gym, lifting weight or doing an exhaustive exercise, then that affects your sleep. You cannot sleep well. So the bottom line is, exercise whenever you can, but if you have room to improve, then it's better to exercise late in the afternoon. So now I have told you a lot of different things, then how to put all of this together? How should be your ideal circadian day? And so in all of our studies, we advise that people should set aside a consistent 8 hours bedtime. It's not you have to sleep for 8 hours. This is your 8 hours quiet time when you go to bed so that you can sleep at least for 6 to 7 hours. Good if you can sleep even more than that. And then after waking up, avoid eating for at least 1 hour after waking up, because that's when your melatonin is still halfway down and your cortisol is peaking, and both of these hormones are bad for our metabolism. So that's why avoid eating for at least 1 hour. In most of our studies, what we see is people wait for 1.5 to 2.5 hours even. And then choose a consistent eating time. In most of our studies, we ask people to eat within 10 hours, not 8, because 8 is difficult. And sometimes when you eat within 8 hours, you may reduce your energy intake, you may eat less. And so 10 is ideal. And then you can go up to 11 or maximum 12, but not beyond 12 hours. Because if you go beyond 12 hours, then you are eating very close to your bedtime. That's bad for your blood glucose control and also bad for your sleep. And also, no bright light for 3 hours before bedtime, because if you dim down the light, then that drives your melatonin release automatically. And during daytime, if you can, daytime activity, and you can combine it with daylight. So late afternoon walk, brisk walk, or outdoor exercise is the best. So we have done quite a few studies. I will not go into detail. So the first study we did was almost 10 years ago in 2015. And that's the time when we thought, well, people are eating for 15 hours. Can they actually choose a 10-hour window and stick to it? Because, you know, there are many discoveries. People will say, well, avocado a day will keep your heart healthy. Can people eat one avocado every single day? So as scientists, we got to ask that question. So we had only 8 people. This is the eating window in red. And then the self-selected eating window, that's in blue. And they had to do it for 16 weeks. And then they lost a modest amount of body weight. They are not obese, they're overweight. And then after 1 year, they still maintain that body weight. So that was really exciting. And when we asked them, why did you keep to this schedule? what is the benefit on a day-to-day basis? They said they were more energetic in the morning and they slept much better at night. And those are the two things that drove them to adopt this, what is now popular as intermittent fasting. And everything else falls into place, because if you sleep better and if you're more energetic, and your mood is better, and you are, and when people eat within 10 hours, they also improve their diet quality, because then they don't have enough time to drink in the late afternoon, late evening. And the dessert intake also goes down. The breakfast quality improves. So a lot of indirect benefits happen. So I've gone to many other studies, and I'll not list up all of them. The other one was metabolic syndrome, when people have high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high cholesterol, or obesity. And what we found was, even though they were already taking medication, they can combine 10-hour eating, and that improved their weight, subjective sleep satisfaction, blood pressure, and cholesterol. So that was only with 19 people, but we expanded now. We have completed now a randomized controlled trial with 100-plus people. Then we asked whether San Diego firefighters who are doing 24-hour shift, can they do 10-hour eating? And this was a risky trial, because 75 firefighters were selecting 10 hours and eating, even on the day they were on the job. And the risk was whether they will respond late to 911 call. And the good thing is they liked it, they loved it. Those who were healthy, they continued to be healthy. And those who had high blood pressure, sugar, or LDL cholesterol, they improved their health. And this is the last study with metabolic syndrome. And what we found was, and I'll give you one example. This is an example of a person who was getting up around 5 o'clock, 5:30, had his breakfast, going to work, and then had one meal, lunch there, and then in the evening would come back and eat dinner before 7 p.m. And everything looked fine, but was actually eating within a long window. So we asked this person to delay the breakfast, take breakfast to work. So now he was eating within a 10 hours window. And the orange is the 24 hours blood glucose measured by continuous glucose monitoring at baseline or before this intervention. And you can see most of the time the blood sugar was above 125. So technically he was a type 2 diabetic. And after just 12 weeks, his blood glucose almost normalized. His fasting blood glucose became 85. This was done with UCSD cardiology department. So we have quite a few examples like this. And then just recently we did a study that we never thought would work. So many people who had COVID, the post-COVID, one third of post-COVID patients actually have a syndrome called POTS. The bottom line is, these people, when they stand up, the heart rate goes up by 30 points or more. So they cannot walk, they cannot take stairs, and many of them cannot keep a regular job. And when we asked them to do this 10 hours time-based eating, and this was a really, we never thought that this would work, only because of Pam Taub, who is the cardiac rehab director in UCSD. She pushed through this, and then we had 20 POTS patients, and we found nearly half of them improved their POTS to the extent that they are no longer diagnosed as POTS patients, because when they stand up, their blood heart rate is not going up by 30 points. So this is exciting. It just came out, and we are applying for a randomized control trial with larger study. So the bottom line is, there are now almost 100 or 150 human studies on time-based eating or intermittent fasting. There are nearly 150 more that are registered that will come out. There are at least 250 mouse and animal studies, and all of these are showing that this time-based eating or intermittent fasting, at least 10 hours in humans, improves a lot of different conditions, from immune system to cardiovascular system to brain health. Even it reduced cancer relapse among breast cancer survivors and improved sleep. And in mouse model and rat model, it increased lifespan. And even rats that were eating longevity diet and they were living 10% longer, sorry, mice, when they combined that with intermittent fasting, although they're eating the same calories from the same longevity diet, now they don't live 10% longer, they live 35% longer. So that was really surprising, and that really says that combining healthy nutrition, combining quality, quantity of nutrition within a set window actually improves your health. Not only that, the circadian rhythm has a lot of other implications. So for example, if you slept better for 7 days and then took your vaccination in the morning, then you have much better protection than the same vaccination taken in the late afternoon or if you haven't slept. So similarly, there are now heart surgeries that seem to be much better outcome if done in the afternoon than in the morning, and by the same team in the same hospital. That came out from Europe. And as I said, chemo and now immunotherapy and even your pain medication taken at bedtime has much better effect on joint pain in the morning than the same pain medication in the morning. So this is a new field called chronomedicine. To learn more, you can go to the website My Circadian Clock through, and we still have the app, and we just collected, finished 200,000 users, and we have a last paper coming out. And we are also partnering with various organizations and even in the private sector to collect more data to see when people do their daily lifestyle. Because I think this fixing your daily lifestyle is a very powerful way to live up to 100 years. And in future, not in distant future, most of your apps will actually compute this and will tell you how to live your life. So here is a 30 days challenge, and the challenge is to try to adopt. If you are not doing, then you can adopt a 10 hour sitting, try to be in bed for 8 hours, and try to dim your light for 2 to 3 hours, and then be outdoor, be active outdoor for at least somewhere between 30 minutes to an hour. And if you try to build this habit in 30 days, then the habit will drive you to your 100 year mark. Thank you. And then, if you want more, then I wrote a book, so a lot of this is in the book. Thank you.
So we have a lot of questions. Are you ready? I have so many myself. Now, this question didn't come from me, but I'm going to start with it because I love it. Does coffee count in starting our 10-hour window?
Yeah, so this always comes up. So in the morning, you ask yourself, why do you need that cup of coffee immediately within an hour of waking up? And usually, there are a few answers. Two are physiological. One is people think that they are not fully awake without coffee. So which tells you that you need more sleep. Okay? So if you are waking up, say, after 6 hours or 7 hours, or maybe you actually need 9 hours of sleep, but you are getting only 7 hours. So that's one reason why you got to ask yourself why. And then the second one that most people don't tell, but we are slowly learning, is people need that coffee for that bowel movement. And then the question is, well, is that coffee or is it warm water? Some warm liquid that will kickstart your bowel movement. Because in the old days, people used to get up, and our hunter-gatherers and farmers, they used to go be active. They will go take care of the animals or do something. That movement will warm up their body for the bowel movement. We don't have that. So try to see whether it's warm water or coffee. Then people who work night shift, so for example, our firefighters, they said there is no way we can stop coffee because it's a public safety, because we don't want them to drive sleepy. And then the other factor is if your job depends on it. If you're working, no one is working here in the TV station or in places where you have to go to your job at 4 o'clock and you have to be awake in front of a TV. So, and then the last reason why you should have your coffee is if it is the only love in your life and you cannot part with it.
There's no way I'm giving that up. So if the idea is delayed a little bit, how long do you recommend delaying it?
Yeah, just like, so one more thing about black coffee. Since many people I hear, they try black coffee, and coffee comes in many strength, many composition. You don't have even control over what you're drinking. What I have seen personally, although there is not much research, is some people after many, many years of drinking morning black coffee in empty stomach may develop acid reflux. So just be mindful, think about that. So if you can delay, means if you can have your coffee with breakfast, that's best. And in fact, Turkish language, breakfast literally means the food before coffee, because you cannot drink that thick Turkish coffee in an empty stomach.
Okay. How about with the change of light, of length of day? So when we have the different changes two times a year, what do you recommend? What are you noticing around those times? So
all the scientists, circadian rhythm scientists and sleep scientists, they actually, there is a lot of studies showing that if we stick to standard time, then it's much better. But then there is a lot of debate depending on where you live. In northern latitude, people don't like the standard time. So there is a lot of debate going on. But what is clear is this time shift actually harms our health, particularly when we fall back. That's the morning when we see, and almost every hospital has recorded spike in heart attack and spike in accidents by teenagers. All of these things happen. And if you think about it, and people have also done research to see what happens when our actual clock, noon time, is synchronized with the sun at the top. And the bottom line is, yes, we are much better. Our health is much better. Our cognitive function is much better when we are aligned. And that comes from the standard time. So, but anyways, this is a political issue. And then some people will like it. Some people don't like it. And bottom line is, when it comes to that time change, particularly fall back, just don't try to wake up an hour early. Since you have the freedom, many of you have the freedom to sleep in, try to sleep in.
That's great. One fascinating takeaway point I had is the time of day can impact your results with, say, radiation treatment, chemotherapy, and even the medications that you take.
Yeah.
I think there's many of us here that want to better understand that. And should we be thinking about that in terms of when we are taking our medications?
Yeah, so that's a great area. That's we call it chronomedicine. And that started with in the 80s when there are two very powerful publications came out, very impactful publications came out in really prestigious journal like Science, showing the chemotherapies, some chemos for breast cancer work much better in the morning, some in the afternoon. And in the intervening years, there are a lot of other studies showing different medications work better. And one is your pain medication for arthritis pain, which although the pain is, people feel more stiffness and pain in the morning, the medication taken at bedtime is much more effective. And that led to new formulation where the medication actually slowly releases. So you take it at bedtime and then it releases towards morning and the pain is better controlled. Then there are some diabetes medications that seem to work at a lower dose if it's taken during the morning than in the afternoon. But the problem is some of the diabetes medications can also make you to go to the bathroom too many times. So that's why doctors don't recommend it. So there are all these practical issues that are preventing the adoption, but slowly we think the tide will turn and then people will adopt, or the pharmaceutical companies will come up with better dosing timing. Because right now the dosing timing is based on convenience. People take their pills either in the morning or in the evening. So if you come up with better studies showing whether the morning or evening is better, then that can get into the practice. Mm-hmm. And for pharma, it's also gives them an edge. So for example, if a medication is better taken in the evening, but in the clinical trial, they recommend it in the morning, that may not work. They may fail in the clinical trial. So they're also trying to understand what timing works better. So we hope that this will affect almost most of the medications that we take.
That's fascinating. Okay, what about cultures that tend to eat relatively late? So if you go to Europe, say, or other countries, right, they're eating really late. What does your research show, or what can you say about that?
So, yeah, people always bring up the example of Spain. And so there are two things that are happening there. So most of the time, you know, you're going to Spain, you're going to big cities. Have you actually gone to a small village in Spain? They don't actually eat that late. It's only in the cities for the tourists. Many restaurants stay open later in the night. The second and more
technical political issue is, if you look in the map, Spain and England are in the same longitude. But why is Spain 1 hour delayed? So when it is 6 p.m. in London, it's actually 7 p.m. in Spain. So that means technically it should be 6 p.m. So when people say that in Spain people eat their dinner at 9 p.m., according to our circadian rhythm and position of the sun, they're actually eating their dinner at 8 p.m., not at 9. So this is a technical glitch about timing in Spain. But there is also studies showing that in Spain, people who eat their dinner after 9 p.m. are at a higher risk for breast cancer and prostate cancer. Men for prostate cancer and women for breast cancer.
Wow.
Yeah. So there is a large study that came out from Spain.
Wow. Okay. So we shouldn't be eating too late. Okay. Talk about sleeping more than 8 hours. Is sleeping more than 8 hours okay, good or bad? And what about taking naps? What can you say about that?
Yeah, so there was a long debate about whether one should sleep long, many, many hours. So that was based on epidemiological data when people are asked how many hours you slept or you typically sleep. And then they looked at their morbidity or what disease they have. And typically people found that those who are sleeping more also had some disease. So they thought that sleeping more leads to disease without thinking that people who are tired and going through some treatment, maybe they need more sleep. So that has been now questioned. So now the answer is, well, try to sleep as much as your body needs, but that doesn't mean that you should actually stop exercising and sleep. And for taking nap, we humans are not fully day active or diurnal. We call ourselves crepuscular. So that means we are designed to be more active at dawn and dusk. And actually our sleep pressure goes up right after our lunch. So that's why we are designed to take a nap. So it's good for us. Or at least we are designed to be taking a nap.
Oh, okay, everybody, go home and take your naps. Dr. Panda says it's okay.
So that one is difficult because, you know, you don't want to take a long nap so that it affects your nighttime sleep. And then it has to be earlier in the afternoon. You should not be napping close to, say, sunset time. Then that pushes. And how long is a very tricky question because some people, they nap for 20 minutes. Some nap for 45. And in our household, even somebody naps for 45, somebody needs 1.5 hour. So it's we still don't understand how much nap a person needs, but what we think is whatever that person needs, they will figure out.
Okay. Can you speak a little bit about the light bulbs that you demonstrated here? There's a lot of curiosity in the room about it. Want to better understand it, and how can we access those? Are they on the market now, or is it still being tested? Where are we at with that?
Yeah, so there must be some. So these are the light bulbs that somebody sent me from Europe, and the same company is now redoing the light bulbs and lighting in ICUs in Europe. So then I was curious about the light. They said, well, this is an interesting light that you don't have to have. You can have the same bulb doing three different acts. So that's why I brought this, but I think in the US also now there'll be circadian lighting. At least the Philips and then many other companies now have this lighting, and from your phone you can adjust what color and brightness it should be. But I thought this was much better in the sense, you know, it's very simple technology. You push once, it's red, push twice, it's medium. Yeah. So the bottom line is this technology will be soon available in the US.
Okay, fantastic. So in your talk, you mentioned how you stopped using sunglasses on your drive to work. So do you have thoughts about, you know, we live in Southern California, a lot of people wearing sunglasses when they're out and about. Do you have thoughts about if sunglasses are good or bad? Or
I mean, I'm not saying good or bad. I mean, for me, just driving and during the day, not early morning or late afternoon when the sun is hitting you. So at that time, of course, you need sunglasses. But for me, I realized that the only time I was getting exposure to bright light was when I was driving. But for most people, you know, it's better to have a pair of sunglasses handy, because when you're walking, taking that late afternoon walk, and if it is sunny in San Diego, 125,000 lux, with sunglasses, you're getting around 10,000 lux.
I see.
Yeah, even with not very dark sunglasses, but medium, you still get, if it is very bright, sunny day, then you can get 5,000 to 10,000 with sunglasses.
Okay, great. So this is a question on intermittent fasting. You didn't mention much about weight loss as a result of intermittent fasting. Is there data on that? And also, what is your opinion on GLP drugs? Is the second part of that question from someone in the audience.
No, so most of the studies on intermittent fasting or time-based eating is on weight loss. And typically, most of the studies, what happens is most studies, they tend to take healthy people who are overweight or obese, and then they're putting them on 8 to 10 hours intermittent fasting. And typically they lose somewhere between 3 to 5% weight. So a 200 pounds person will lose, say, 20 pounds max. So that's 10%. So what we are seeing is there is a difference in some people are driven for weight loss and they will stick to it and they will see much more benefit than some other people who are just overweight and obese. They don't have any other condition. They don't need to lose weight. So that's where the dynamics comes. And for GLP-1, we just had one study that is completing where we had type 2 diabetics and more than half of them, or roughly half of them, were already taking GLP-1. They're already stable on GLP-1. And we're finding that they're still getting more benefit in glucose control from this 10 hours time-restricted eating. We did not collect any information about side effects, like GLP-1 for some people can have side effects. But at least for purely glucose control, that's where they were taking, we saw even more benefit when they combined it.
What's GLP?
So these are the Ozempic class of drugs. Yes.
The weight loss drugs for people. Okay, here's another question I know a lot of people in the room are going to want to know. Does alcohol impact circadian rhythms?
Yes, it does.
Darn it.
Well, you can have a happy hour, early happy hour.
So early happy hour.
Early happy hour.
Okay.
So what we have seen is when people do intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, the tolerance for alcohol goes down. So that means if they needed 3 glasses of wine, now they're okay with 1 glass and they cannot take the second glass. So.
Okay. People are asking about blue light from laptops versus TVs.
Yeah, so the bottom line is if you're actually standing far away from your TV or sitting there, then there may not be much effect. But with the caveat that nowadays, most of the TVs you buy are very large. And then if you're watching them, the thing is most of the shows, if you think about it, most of the action shows have a lot of blue light because blue alerts us. Action is always paired with blue. So the point is, another thing that many people can do is you can try a pair of blue filtering glasses. And a good blue filtering glasses will make you look really funky because those are either yellow or red color. If somebody's trying to sell you a blue filtering glass and that looks clear, that's filtering maybe 5% or 2% of blue light, not 50 to 70%. And once you wear it, after a while, you'll get used to it. So then you can still watch the TV. And I have a pair. Sometimes I use them.
Okay, great. There's a lot of questions here about exercise in the morning versus exercise in the afternoon. I know that you mentioned in your talk that exercise in the afternoon is, you know, whenever you can get it is best, but there is some benefit to it in the afternoon?
Yeah, so exercise at any time is better, and particularly morning if you're going outdoor for a walk or run or brisk walk, whatever you're doing outdoor is even much better because you are synchronizing your clock with the bright light and exercise. And the afternoon exercise, this is something that that was brewing for a long time. From 80s, people have seen that when West Coast team flies to East Coast and plays Monday night football, then they had an advantage over the home team. And the advantage was better than Las Vegas odds score. So that means if you're into sports betting and you know when the West Coast team flew, so then you'd. So then the idea was in the late afternoon when the West Coast team is playing Monday night football in East Coast, they're actually at their late afternoon. And then the home team is at late night. So that led to all this research about what time is good for exercise. And they found that even for elite athletes, the late afternoon exercise is much better because there is less risk for injury and the performance is better. And then a few years ago, there was a study from Stockholm where they took type 2 diabetic patients and gave them the exercise in the morning. And the same patients went and did the exercise in the afternoon and vice versa. Some started with the afternoon and morning. Supervised exercise, the same thing, and they found that those who did late afternoon exercise, the blood glucose control was better than those who did in the morning. So that is now replicated a couple of times. So the bottom line is anytime exercise is good, but if you want to get the best bang, then late afternoon. There is also less risk for fall in the late afternoon exercise and brisk walking. So that's another reason why late afternoon may be better, but it's up to, means if you can do it in the morning, that's fine.
And if we do it after dinner, say, will that impact our sleep?
That seems to impact, but it's, again, these are done on people who are doing high volume exercise. They're going to the gym and they're lifting weight or something. And this is where there is a confound, because if you're exercising, you're also under bright light. No, gym is dimly lit. So that's the confound, so that we have to figure out. But we know that exercise will raise your heart rate and then your core body temperature. And then the question is, after exercise, if you take a shower, will that help to go to sleep? So those minor details have not been figured out.
Okay, so you don't know yet if that...
No.
Okay, got it. Okay. Okay, what about, talk about travel out of the U.S. or just even... throughout the U.S. when you're going to change time zones.
Yeah.
Do you have suggestions, and how do you manage it? I'm sure you travel a lot for your job.
Yeah.
How do you manage the time zones and sort of recovering and the impact it has on your health?
Yeah, so since you're in San Diego, most of the flights from San Diego will leave in the late early morning. And you are typically waking up very early, 3 or 4, even 2 sometimes, to go to the airport. So what happens? The day before you travel, you have less sleep. So not only jet lagged, you actually have less sleep. And then on the day of the travel, you have few things. You get on the flight and your instinct is to, you know, you're all well-to-do. You walk into a lounge in the morning at 5 or 6, and then you have your coffee and some food. And that's actually not that good for you because at that time, your body is not ready. If you're actually typically eating breakfast at 7 or 8, then you're eating much earlier. So my rule of thumb is on the day of travel, I just go straight to the flight and no breakfast, no coffee, no Starbucks, nothing. And then the good thing is in flight, so I know how to sleep in any seat, economy, any seat. Okay.
That's a gift.
No, I have my neck pillow, inflatable neck pillow, my eye mask, my earplugs, my sensory deprivation. So if you don't drink coffee, the nice thing is you feel so sleepy from sleep deprivation, you'll sleep through the flight. So when you reach at your destination, you are much more awake, you are more alert, and you are less tired. And then wherever you are flying, another thing that happens is flying is subjecting your body to a lot of vibration. Just imagine all the vibration that happens. And you are flying at in a cabin that's pressurized to 15,000 feet. So that means you're almost living in aspen and low oxygen. So that's why you feel tired and you think that that's jet lag, but partly it's tiredness from low oxygen, vibration. So then when you reach the destination, it's much better to take a warm bath because your muscles are sore. And that's why I have a nose strip to open my nostril when I'm flying so that I can breathe some extra air because it's oxygen poor.
Yeah.
If you're flying to Europe, then that's a different thing because most of the flights to Europe will start in the late afternoon, early evening, and you reach Europe in the morning. If you're connecting through East Coast, it's only 6 to 7 hours, 8 hours. If you're connecting through San Francisco, 11 hours. So the only thing you should be doing in overnight flight to Europe is sleep. Have your meal in the ground, or if you're in business class, you ask the person to do express dining, one meal, and then just go sleep. Because, you know, breakfast is much better in Europe than the in-flight breakfast.
But I find that coming back is so much harder. Why is that? The returning back and adjusting, it could take me sometimes like almost a week now to recover.
Because you're returning back, you're staying awake throughout the flight. So your day is extremely long. And when you're returning, you are also waking up very early in Europe because you have to get to your connecting. If you're not flying from a major city, you're connecting from different cities, then your early morning, you are leaving at 6 o'clock. And since it's international, you have to be there before 5. So you're sleep deprived. And then you get into the flight and you're like, okay, I got to watch this movie and then I have to have 2 or 3 martinis. And so you essentially go through almost 24 hours, close to 24 hours of sleep deprivation. And then it becomes, then it kind of
takes some time to catch back up.
Domino effect.
Yeah.
So again, the same thing. Like if you, no alcohol in flight, and no TV because, you know, your visual system occupies half of your brain. With low oxygen, your brain is working really hard to watch that movie. So eye mask is your best friend. Eye mask, earplug, inflatable head and neck pillow.
Okay. The list of must-get items from Dr. Panda for international travel right here, everybody. Okay, we've got 2 more questions here. You talked a lot about shift workers and the impact that it has on them and also their families, right?
Yeah.
Do you have advice on how to prepare for that and how to recover?
That's really hard. And we did that with firefighters, and firefighters in San Diego do 24-hour shift. But we're currently doing a study on night shift nurses in UCSD and many hospitals because the night shift is very difficult. Because in many cases, they actually flip them back to day shift. So we are trying to figure out whether they can, we are changing. Actually, this is a study done by Emily Manoogian in my group. And she's doing it with UCSD and a few other hospitals. The idea is, can they do a intermittent fasting kind of between, say, noon to midnight? But then if they're hungry after midnight, can they have a low-carbohydrate snack? And so it's a little bit complicated, but it seems to be off to a great start because we had, I think she had 15 nurses, and many of them are seeing benefits, so they're sticking to it. So there is also another study by our group for older people who want to combine time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting with a personal trainer for exercise and light regulation. So this is just starting, and I'll leave some flyers. So, you know, shift work is hard, and shift work is very different. Even within UCSD, different departments have different shifts for fellows and interns. So.
Okay, so I have a couple of these questions that have come in about, you mentioned how we want to sort of reduce our light a few hours before we're getting ready for bed, right? Many people watch TV before bed. What are your thoughts about the light from a television?
Yeah, so that's what I meant. Don't, in your television setting, try to reduce the brightness. Initially, it might feel awkward, but then after a while, you'll get used to it. Like, the same thing happened in our household. The challenge now is the TV sets are so big that even at dim light, you're getting a lot of light. So don't try to go for the biggest, largest TV screen. Try to have a moderate-sized TV screen. Stay far away. And then in the worst case, you can also use blue filtering glasses. That helps.
Okay, and I'm guessing the same thing with screens, right?
Like the screens,
your phone.
Yeah, so there's
recommendations on that.
So there is a night shift feature in most laptops and phones. So you can go and check that. And if you set it, for example, in my phone, it's at 8:30 p.m. when the phone goes warm color, like orange color, and also dims down. It's also a nudge to myself that I should wind down and get ready for sleep. So the phones, laptops, you can program. The TVs, actually, the technology is coming soon that they will slowly reduce the blue in a way that you won't even notice. But the challenge is the TV manufacturers and the content creators, they're in a fight. Because the content creators want you to sit there and watch, binge watch. So at the end, it has to be a lot of self-control and mindset. And without that, it'll be almost impossible because we are really swimming in the toxins of all the bad food, bad light, and bad habits. So we have to come up with that self-control and mindset.
Okay. Well, can we give a big round of applause for Dr. Panda?
Thank you.
Just wow. This was such a fantastic day. I loved your talk. So much practical information to take away. I want to end the day with thanking our sponsors and the visions behind this talk, Dr. Lim and his wife, beautiful wife, Linda Lim. Thank you both so much. Without their vision, we wouldn't be doing this talk today. And lastly, if you want to learn more about the Stein Institute, what we do, all the talks we have, and the exciting research we have going on, you can find us at aging.ucsd.edu. So with that, thanks you all for being here today, and thanks, Dr. Panda.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.